Ladies and gentlemen, it is a real privilege and treat for me to welcome to the Celeria Report Eric Best. I have wanted for many years to do a Celeria Report on scenario planning and scenario design. It's a way of, I think, approaching the future that I am that I use and am comfortable with. If you look at the annual wrap-ups, you'll see scenarios and probabilities assigned to scenarios. The reason I have not done a Celeria Report on scenario planning is that it's a technique, it's a practice that really requires the master. So I didn't want to do it unless I knew someone was available who I considered to be excellent. Eric Best is, in fact, a former member of a group in California who taught me scenario planning and design, and he really stood out at that group as the person who I thought was the most gifted at the practice. He had come to that group as a journalist. He had 20 years of experience in journalism, but not surprisingly, given his success there, he got scarfed up by Morgan Stanley in the mid-90s. To help them with strategic planning and strategic design. And then in 2006, founded Best Partners, which specializes in helping corporations and other groups with this kind of strategic planning. He is also an author and speaker, having worked, as I said, as a journalist for many years before turning to strategic planning. He is also the author of Into My Father's Wake, which is the story of a 5,000-mile solo sail from San Francisco to Hawaii and back, and also a children's book called The Deep. So a very accomplished person, and I think our focus on the Celeria Report is not on predicting the future, but inventing the future. And this is certainly a practice that I think can help us make that switch. So Eric Best, welcome to the Celeria Report. You are a sight for sore eyes.
Well, thank you very much, Catherine. It's very nice of you to have me on your show here, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about something that I've, you know, spent a lot of time doing and, you know, am very interested in. So I always say to people, you can't really sell scenario thinking. It has to be bought by somebody who's curious and kind of believes in the principle that we can't predict the future, but we have to behave, we have to act. So what should we do? So I'm all yours for the next hour.
Well, before we dive in, I've recommended to the Celeria Report subscribers that they watch the video. It's our Let's Go to the Movies video this week. A wonderful video that you have on your website called The Four Principles. And in it, you tell a quote, the sea lies in wait for the unwary, but she stalks the reckless. And you should have seen me. I was laughing on the floor when I saw it. I think of the kind of work you do and really deep, you call it scenario thinking, scenario planning is very important for being well prepared in a world, particularly with the uncertainty we have. And yet, I have always struggled my entire career with getting my team to be willing and eager to spend the time they need to really do it well. And yet, I know there are countless stories of the organizations that have done it well making extraordinary differences.
Well, no, I didn't mean to interrupt, but you know, I think, first of all, the human anxiety about the unknown motivates us to seek answers, even if they're not necessarily really answers, or to seek solace in some notion of certainty or predictability. And some people rise in organizations or in groups because they appear to have the answer. And I would say, you know, McKinsey is a consultancy based on the notion that we are very smart people with answers, so if you ask us, we'll tell you what the answer is or what to do. If you put that on some sort of an axis, you put McKinsey or knowing the answer on one end of the axis, I would put scenario thinking and trying to get to the right question on the other end. acknowledging that we, you know, we cannot predict and we have to try to prepare. And so how might we do that? One way to do that is to be very thoughtful and inclusive about the uncertainties that surround us. And the process that I learned at Global Business Network in the early 90s and then spent 10 years refining at Morgan Stanley around the world in, you know, all the businesses, many of the businesses that Morgan Stanley was involved in with its clients. My work has really been to figure out how to structure uncertainty to get to the kinds of ideas that should matter the most to the people who need to know. And in those organizations where people have risen on the basis of having the answer, it can be hard to get people to stop and acknowledge they don't really know, but they're willing to think hard about the things that ought to matter most to them. And those things that ought to matter the most to them have implications for actions that they might need to take or they might need to think about. And the principle here is the prepared mind can act in time, or the prepared mind is more likely to act in time. You mentioned right. You mentioned that great quote, "The sea lies in wait for the unwary, but she stalks the reckless." That came from an instructor of a navigation course that I took before I sailed to Hawaii on my own the first time, and it's, you know, it's a little bit chilling, but it's a reminder that unwary means not wary. You need to be wary, and the ocean is a great right. metaphor for the economy. There are forces at work that can come together unexpectedly and produce, you know, wave conditions or wind conditions that you'd better be prepared for. And God help you if you're reckless, which means you just don't care about the danger, you're not thinking about it. So I found in my life, you know, a convergence between my love of sailing and being in the ocean and ways of thinking about business problems that acknowledge that, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, but there's certain things we can think about and should think about more deeply with a technique, which the scenario process is.
Right. I would mention when I was a partner at Dillon Reed in the boardroom, we had something that you saw in many boardrooms in those days on Wall Street, and that was you had an oil painting of a calm sea on one end of the boardroom, and on the other you had a painting of a ship almost, you know, crashing and burning in the ocean. And it was a reminder that there are good times and bad times, and we needed to navigate both successfully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you mentioned the four principles. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about those now, but
yeah, let's talk about those and then we'll dive into what is scenario planning.
Yeah. Well, so which came first, the chicken or the egg? Those four principles, I will say, came to me at a certain moment. I stepped off the curb on Fifth Avenue near the New York Library about 2 weeks after I came to Morgan Stanley in the fall of 1996. And I'd been doing scenario thinking at Global Business Network for the 6 years prior to that. And I came to Morgan Stanley, as you know, because they wanted to think about what the internet would mean to financial services, which was a very good question to ask in 1995. Right. You know, we don't have all the answers, but I stepped off the curb, and these four thoughts came to me, which I realized really had come out of the scenario work I'd been doing for the last, you know, half decade, and they're quite simple. The first is clarify the intention. What is it I'm trying to do? The second one is define the sacred, which is to say, what is it that means so much to me? What are the values that I hold dear that I'm not going to abandon those no matter what? I'm going to stick to that or fight for that or hold on to that because it's sacred. The third one is understand the commitment, because if I know what my intention is and I know what I hold sacred, then I should be able to figure out what it means that I must do or I must have or I must seek in terms of resources or determination. What will it take? And the final one, which is maybe my favorite and is often, I think, misunderstood, is simply act to be. Now, people have said, well, what exactly does that mean? And I'll tell you what it's based on. When I went to Hawaii the first time, as I was a journalist then, and I happened to meet a guy who was a quite well-known developer and had developed a property on the islands, David Murdoch, who had built controversial hotels on the island of Lanai. And I managed to get an interview with him, even though he was known to not want to ever talk to any journalists ever for any reason. And when I met him, he was a very interesting, vibrant man. And he kind of jumped up and down, it seemed to me, while he was talking. Anyway, he said to me, well, now, you understand something because you decided to sail here alone, and you sailed here alone, and now you know something that can never be taken away, and you understand things that you could have only come to understand that way, and that's because you decided to act to be. And then he went on to say, people think it's wrong to have an ego. No, it's not wrong to have an ego. It's wrong to have no ego. And as we act, so we become. And then he went on to talk about his own life in those terms. And I, you know, picked that up and, you know, found myself stepping off this curb in New York 7 years later with that phrase in my mind as the fourth principle, which fitted with scenario thinking, because scenario thinking is about clarifying your intention in light of who you are and what you think you're doing here in the context of the world as we find it, which is full of uncertainty. Define the sacred as a way of recognizing something we know that, whether it's human behavior or corporate behavior, core values really matter. And we know that companies and individuals who have core values and stick to them tend to do better than those who don't. So the understand the commitment part is from seeing in the corporate context, in a managerial context, you know, you will know this too, that you can have people at the top of the company declaring this is what we're going to do publicly to, you know, create the story on which, you know, their future stock value is supposed to be based. But under the covers or behind the curtain, they're actually not making the commitment. They're not investing in the technology. They're not,
right,
you know, they're not dealing with personnel issues. They're not deciding on a geographic strategy that makes any sense, whatever. They're not thinking about what the commitment is that's required to fulfill that intention or to fulfill those values. And then the act to be part is, I think, you know, so important in terms of individuals who want to accomplish something, want to become something, want to establish something, want to be known a certain way, want to be trusted, want to be believed, etc. Well, as you behave, so you will become. And so those are the four principles.
Okay, scenario. Now, do you describe it as scenarios, scenario planning, scenario thinking? What's the verbiage you use?
Well, I prefer scenario thinking, and the reason for that is that scenario is a term that's used a lot. It's used in the movie business to mean high concept. Mm-hmm. It's used in the insurance business to mean, you know, one of three different possible interest rates, which I don't view as a scenario. It's used sometimes by people to mean my prediction. Here's my scenario, which,
right,
you know, may be useful. But when I say scenario, I mean it's a qualitative rather than a quantitative version of a future. And good scenarios, and Jay Ogilvy, who was a mentor of mine at Global Business Network, liked to say this, scenarios have to travel in packs. You know, one scenario is a prediction. Two scenarios is kind of like up or down. Three scenarios is up or down or sideways. So I've learned the best answer is four scenarios built around a very studied idea of what the most important uncertainties are, and that's arrived at through, you know, a lot of research and discussion, et cetera. But once you can get the group of people, you know, let's say the 20 people in the company who really run the place, if you can
right.
get them in a room to do the work to determine what they believe are the most important uncertainties, then if they apply those to produce the four different scenarios that logically flow from those uncertainties, and they think through each of those individually, and then they think through them collectively, and then they derive from those the implications for themselves, which means what options should we think about, what options could we think about, what options will we actually act on. If they do that, they will be ahead of the competition.
Yes. Yes, it's quite remarkable.
I say that, and somebody listening might say, yeah, well, of course you would say that. And all I can say by way of, you know, trying to substantiate my claim is that in years of doing this work, I've seen examples in rooms of people wrestling with this problem where suddenly the big aha actually leaps into the room and everybody sees it and everybody feels it. And the person in the room responsible for, you know, the group takes ownership of it and acts on it. And,
right.
You know, I have on my website in the introduction to scenario thinking an article I wrote about a case study in Japan in 1997 where this occurred, where in trying to think through the future of Japan, a young person in the room came to the view that, well, wait a minute, there's really no upside in Japan for the next 3 to 5 years in the way we're thinking about it. And this caused the room to fall silent. And after several moments, the oldest guy in the room, a guy named Harrison Young, who's now a banker in Australia, said, well, why would we buy anything then? Which was the question to ask, because at that
right.
time, Morgan Stanley was thinking about buying Yamaichi Securities. Why? Well, because Western banks were thinking if the Japanese have 12 trillion in yen in savings, wouldn't it be great to, you know, get in the way of that as it went by, as they invested? And so it seemed like a good idea to buy a Japanese retail broker. Well, based on this insight in the room, which led to a discussion of why, if Japan wasn't going to turn around in the next 3 to 5 years, it made sense to behave more like a merchant bank and help them, you know, buy and sell the family silver as the economy went kind of sideways and slightly down. Terry Porte, who ran Morgan Stanley Japan at the time, decided, okay, that's what we're going to do. We're not going to buy anything. And so that's what Morgan Stanley did and made, you know, a lot of money in Japan for the next 5 years. Meanwhile, Merrill Lynch bought Yamaichi and lost $1.2 billion.
Wow.
As they would later, you know, report. And I was just never able to convince anybody that I should have been paid a percentage of that $1.2
billion. Right.
So it goes.
There are a couple things that I find happen when you do this kind of scenario thinking, as you call it. One is I can think that I'm really thinking big and I'm really seeing all the forces at work and I'm really on top of things. And then I get in the room and do this and suddenly I realize, oh my God, I'd really fallen down in my own little ditch here, hadn't I? It raises you out of sort of small-mindedness is the only way I can describe it. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would, and I've seen examples of that, and as you say that, what comes to mind is a case where I went and did some work on behalf of GIC, the Government Investment Corporation in Singapore, and we did scenarios,
mm-hmm.
and around 2001, 2002, somewhere in there, for the fixed income division, and, you know, we spent a long day on a framework that we helped develop for them with them. And I was invited back a year later to sort of do a reprise or get the same people back in the room to say kind of where are we now. And I asked the guy who was the head of fixed income for GIC, Well, so what difference did that make a year ago? Because, you know, the consultant's dilemma is, well, how do I know anything makes a difference? So he looked at me and he said, well, here's what happened. He said, I sat in the room and I listened to the people talk about the four different scenarios. And at the end of the conversation, I realized we weren't nearly long enough volatility that our portfolio was really, you know, underexpressed in that respect. And so we changed a number of positions, and that made the portfolio for the year, just by acknowledging that we miscalculated how volatile the world was. Well, I think that's really a great example because, first of all, it shows you why talking through all of the scenarios really matters. So you don't get stuck in a prediction or you don't get stuck in your official future because everybody's got an official future. And then it's also about the person in the room who is A, responsible, B, open, and C, ready to act based on what they take to be the insight. Because I believe that executive decisions are taken, yes, after thought and research, et cetera, but at some point somebody feels that the time has come to act. I know enough. I have enough conviction. I've been moved to move. And that's what happened there. He was moved to move. And you know, I could give you other examples that are along those lines.
Well, I don't know if you remember, I took Jay down to CalPERS in 95 or 96 to try and persuade them to use, you know, I was working with the president of CalPERS, and I was hoping that they would start to integrate scenario thinking into their planning for the portfolio at CalPERS.
Well, you know, some time went by, and eventually Joe Deere, I don't know if you knew him, he's no longer living, sadly, but he hired me to do some work there, and, you know, my observation would be that CalPERS as a as an institution of players, you know, the people in the room, were actually very resistant to thinking outside of their particular box. You know, I mean, herd behaviors in financial markets are so powerful that people are afraid to stick their head above the parapet or stray from the norm. And so, I mean, we could talk about current markets and how many people are behaving because they feel they must behave that way because they feel central banks are going to continue to behave a certain way. And this will go on for as long as it goes on until it doesn't. But in the meantime, I'm not going to behave other than, you know, my competitors and my peers.
It's a long story for another time, but one of the things the president, Bill Crist, communicated to me was the sense that, you know, politically they were really under clear direction as to where they needed to be and where they needed to go so that they're, you know, they didn't have a lot of internal flexibility as a practical matter. So let's turn to how we would use this now, because as background, what every Solaris subscriber knows and what you don't know is that I have been a very forceful, solitary voice saying, can we stop trying to predict the future and get, you know, get into inventing the future? Ever since the early 2000s, we've had an enormous number of people in the alternative financial media, you know, trying to very accurately predict what's going to happen and really getting stuck on scenarios, many of which are very negative. And you know, I've constantly been saying, look, I'm not a prophet. No one can predict the future. But I need to make sure, and this gets into family planning and family offices and family wealth, what I want to make sure is that families are growing and preserving and growing their wealth, and that they're invested in a way that they're fine in all scenarios. I'm not vested in any particular scenario. I'm invested in them being successful, no matter what the future is, and doing it in a way that, if anything, they can contribute to a better future, because we all have to contribute to a better future if we're all going to have one.
Yeah. So, I completely agree with that. I'm thinking now of a client I had, which is a very old, big family fortune in Europe, that is in, you know, a combination of property, apparel, and private equity now, having evolved away from a foundation that was entirely apparel. And in that scenario discussion, which took place first at the corporate level and then in the family office level, what people began to realize as they talked through, okay, this scenario is really kind of like our official future. This is kind of what we think is going to happen and what we think we're prepared for. This scenario over here is if things went really wrong. These other two scenarios are about dimensions of uncertainty that are more cultural, geographic, and behavioral, and have a technology, more of a technology flavor, let's say, in which across that whole canvas, there are certain kinds of opportunities that look to us like good opportunities no matter what happens. And that's a very, very important ingredient in the scenario discussion. Yes, it does give you a clearer sense of what could go wrong and how it might go wrong and what if it did go wrong, but it concurrently gives you a clearer sense of what is the nature of opportunity here that may reside in, you know, more than two scenarios, and those are the opportunities you want. It also gets you to think about and try to define for yourself what Pierre Vach, who was the sort of the grandfather of this in Royal Dutch Shell years ago, used to talk about the predetermined elements. What's true in all scenarios that we really need to think about? So, I mean, I would say now it's predetermined that there's one hell of a lot of debt piling up, for example. So whatever if you're in financial scenarios, or if you're in sovereign wealth, you'd say, well, in every scenario, something is happening to the debt. And in every scenario, something is happening to, you know, banking policy or central bank policy. And once you sit in a room and think about that, you can decide, you know, how deeply do you want to get into that? And what do you think is going to happen? And so what? But it would equally apply if you were trying to think about, let's say, technology in retail or robotics or artificial intelligence or, you know, pick your big theme. There's danger and there's opportunity, and you have to think about all of it.
So let's talk about this thing about debt piling up, because one of the things I talk a lot about is the fact that we are at the end of a long-term bull market in bonds. It's hard to imagine interest rates going down as much as they've gone down in the last 20, 30 years, or, you know, that the debt capacity would increase as much as it has over the last 20 years. So one way or another, in terms of a financial model, we're at a turn. And if you look at what's going on globally, we're seeing enormous debate about what the model we're going to use, not just for the economy, but society. So, whether it's the U.S. fighting with Russia about what the model is going to be, or in the campaign during this election season, people fighting about what the model, you know, there's a real battle royale going on about what model we're going to use, because when you globalize, you're going to have to change the model from what we've been doing for the last 500 years. So how could we use scenario planning to help us navigate that change?
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of ways. It depends, you know, where you want to start and on behalf of whom. I mean, I'm fond of saying that, you know, there are no really off-the-shelf scenarios, one-size-fits-all, here, take these, try these on.
Right.
You really have to start with a strategic question or intention and use that as the stake in the ground that allows you to discover, you know, which uncertainties are more important than others. But, you know,
so
to take a recent...
You go ahead.
Well, I was going to say take a recent client case. Okay, a very, 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 very big asset manager trying to think through, you know, what should we care about? The matter of central bank policy, you know, gets into the middle of it. And,
right.
And currency. And what do you mean, money printing? How many versions of that, quantitative easing, bond buybacks, et cetera? You know, how far does that go? I mean, when you were speaking a moment ago, I resisted the temptation to interrupt, to say, well, let me ask you something, Catherine. If I had said to you 10 years ago, so in 2006, I had said to you, you know, rates are going to go negative in 2015. I don't think you would have said, yeah, absolutely. I think you would have said, what?
Actually, I would have said that's possible.
Well, you would have been rare. You would have been rare if you'd said that. And I'm not saying it was completely unthinkable, but the inflation story was, you know, always hanging there as, you know, inflation is right around the corner. If you'd said that Japan in 2000, well, let's go back to, you know, the mid-80s, early 80s. The story at Harvard was Japan was going to take over the world. The U.S. needed an industrial policy. You know, Robert Reich was saying we needed an industrial policy. And Ezra Vogel was writing Japan is number one, blah, blah, blah. Okay, those scenarios were completely wrong. And then if you go forward further to, you know, where was Japan going? I remember being invited to be on a panel in Japan in around 2003 or 4, and rates were low in Japan then. I can't remember where they were, but I remember saying and thinking I was being kind of funny, but I realized, okay, that wasn't really that funny. But I said, you know, the reason there's low interest rates in Japan is that nobody's interested in Japan. Because what is it about Japan that's really interesting? What are they doing? You know, are they really reforming? Do they have the demographics? You know, blah, blah, blah. But then I don't think anybody would have said, you know, 10 years from now, Japan will be where it is. And that's why I think scenarios are a good approach to use on the subject of, well, what do you think is happening in the dollar-denominated world where the hegemon, the U.S., is behaving with respect to its balance sheet a bit like a third world country, and people who have, you know, sort of bought the system, allowed the U.S. to, you know, be in control, China or other countries, may be saying, wait a minute, I'm not sure I like this deal. So how long does that go on? In what form? I don't know any way to think about that except scenarically, because I can't begin to predict which actors will behave in what way. And if Larry Summers is going to Japan saying, yeah, I think the government should start buying equities. Aren't we in kind of a new system?
So let me describe the point of view that I'm dealing with the most. So we'll take the concept of a family office that's responsible, you know, think of this as a mini asset manager, is responsible for allocations across real estate, private equity, cash, securities, whether it's fixed income or equities. And they're having to contemplate less fixed income and more equity just because at some point you're better off in something real. But at the same time, the purpose of the family office, yes, they want to get a good performance in their portfolio, but the purpose is to help all the individual members of the family succeed as human beings. Mm-hmm. I'm a great fan of Jay Hughes, who wrote a book called Family Wealth, and it's about preserving wealth, but doing it in a way that you really preserve and support the human and intellectual capital of the family by investing in the dreams, some of which make money and some of which, you know, create great culture or other things. Anyway, so you're dealing with both the human and intellectual capital side and a financial capital side. You want both to be successful, but deep in the economy, there's some very win-lose things going on between those two sides of, you know, the collective economy. And meantime, the models are all in flux. And so it makes it, in a funny kind of way, it's even much more complicated than than an asset manager because of the human side of the equation. And what I've been saying lately is my concern is I think we're coming into an inflection point. You know, the growth of debt has papered over a lot of disagreements about the model.
Yes.
It's just like, okay, I used to work in Washington and just pay everybody off and shut up and we'll go down the road another year.
Right. It's can kicking.
Right, can kicking. So we've been can kicking for politically on the federal budget in the United States for 20 plus years. There's a great quote, the quote I used this year from the German finance minister who said in Shanghai at the G20 meeting, he said, the debt finance growth model is over. There are no shortcuts that aren't real reforms. And what he was basically saying is, okay, now we have to deal with real optimization in the fundamental economics and the equity side. And that's going to be politically very painful. And my concern is when I look at the debate going on in the United States and around the world, the real debate to me is, are we going to be a human society or an inhuman society, or a humane society or an inhumane society? And that's a real, as you would say, you know, what's the sacred value here? That's a real deep struggle. And trying to manage money on top of that is a nightmare.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I think you put a bunch of stuff, you know, on the table there all at the same time. But one observation I would make is the discussion about are we going to be a humane society or an inhumane society, that is a natural scenario question implying an axis of uncertainty around what do you mean humane, what do you mean inhumane. And that might be a very fruitful conversation for, you know, certain people to have. The second thing I wanted to say is, as you were quoting somebody saying, you know, we're at the end of the cycle, we're going to have to deal with the fundamentals here, we can't keep going on like this.
Right.
That is a scenario logic. That says this has to come to some kind of an end sooner than later. Okay, that's a scenario logic, because I will offer you an alternative, which is that, no, it does not have to end sooner than later. It can actually go on much longer than you think.
Right.
And so if you're an insurance company or you're a pension or you're an endowment and you think, well, this can't go on. This is just too painful. How am I supposed to get returns in a zero interest rate world? Well, by the way, the world wasn't designed for you to succeed anyway. You have no manifest... You have no manifest destiny to do well here. And oh, by the way, the U.S. has no manifest destiny to remain the currency of the world. You know, Britain was eclipsed. I would commend people's attention to Barry Eichengreen's book, Exorbitant Privilege, about, you know, why does the U.S. occupy the role that it has, and what does it mean to be the trading currency? And if you are the trading currency and you're diminishing the value of that currency because of the way you're behaving fiscally, what's the future? These questions matter, and how they're going to play out are not certain. So being prepared for a few different paths, or thinking about, if I can't convince myself that it's going to end soon and I know how, or it's going to end soon and I don't know how, but I know what's going to be hurt more than something else. And I can see that it really could go on for quite some time, at whose expense and given, you know, what opportunities. This is exactly why you do the thinking.
Right.
I can tell you, I say to my kids, I've been extremely lucky to have had such a weird life that I was a journalist and, you know, learned to believe in inquiring before I tried to figure out what the story was. And then I learned scenario thinking, which is about a certain kind of inquiry that enabled me to be in the room again and again and again and again and in interviews, you know, one-on-one with very, very, very smart, thoughtful, highly educated, experienced people in the world.
Uh-huh.
And maybe a disproportionate number of those in a kind of broken financial system, but nonetheless, very, very insightful people. And I feel the one thing I've really learned is the best you can do is to inquire as thoughtfully and as thoroughly as you can, and listen as deeply as you can, and wait for something to emerge to hit you as something worth acting on, and then act on it. But don't think that you necessarily got the future right, or that
right.
it's over. Okay, now it's fixed. I got it. I'm done. No, it's continuous. It doesn't go away. These,
right.
you know, roiling waves of uncertainty and change are not going to stop because, you know all this stuff. Moore's Law, Metcalfe's Law, miniaturization, material science, biology, artificial intelligence, it's not going to go away. So you can
right.
either snap on the VR and take an opioid, or or you can figure out, how do I want to be engaged, and how do I want to engage other people, and who do I want to be engaged with, and why, if I do that, will I feel that I am having a fruitful life in which, you know, I have defined the sacred, and I do understand the commitment, and I am acting to be, and that's the best I can hope for. That's a human life, and that can be taken at the individual or the enterprise level. And
okay, so let's say I'm a family office manager or a family matriarch, I'm an asset manager. How, listening to this now, I say, okay, I'm interested. How do I learn more? And what are the simple nuts and bolts of how I start to practice this?
Well, you know, without giving away, you know, my entire consulting practice here, you know, in a few minutes, I would say, if what I'm saying makes sense to you, and you're in a family office, and I have a good friend who's responsible for his family office, and, you know, he wants me to help, but his family, you know, wouldn't necessarily trust him to bring in his friend. You know,
right.
It's one of those weird things. You know, there are all these considerations. But, you know, what I say to him is, look, the family has to have a conversation in and amongst itself, you know, aided and abetted by insights from outsiders or intelligence from outsiders, unless the family thinks, no, we're in complete control of all the knowledge that we need. They need to have a conversation about their intention and what's sacred and what does it take and what are they going to do. Those are the four principles
right.
applied to the family office. So somebody in the family office has to say, hey, look, guys, we need to have this kind of conversation. And we can manage it ourselves, or no, we can't manage it ourselves, and we shouldn't try because it's too hard. We need somebody to help us have the conversation that's our conversation. We're not asking an expert to tell us what to do, but we're going to work our way through what we intend, what we care deeply about, what it's going to take, what are we going to do in light of the uncertainties as we see them. And we're not interested in putting our head in the sand out of fear of uncertainty. No, we're actually interested in identifying the opportunities that will be wealth creating in the future that can withstand the conditions in the ocean as we see them. With all
right.
the talk of global warming, I think people need to think about global economic warming. They need to
right.
realize that the history of 100-year storms has changed. We're having more 100-year storms every year than we ever did. Why? Well, because there are things in the atmosphere that weren't there before, and therefore we have to prepare for peak conditions that we didn't used to have to think about. The easiest example of this would be, you know, trading on Wall Street, where when, you know, panic hits the markets, do you think these machines will actually handle, you know, a million trades per second or whatever, you know, the number is? Because in a sailboat, when the wind goes up, the force on the sail goes up exponentially. So if you think it's only going to blow 30, you can have up whatever you can have up if it blows 30. But if you have that up and it blows 70, you're in trouble. And somebody might
right.
say to you, did you not think about it blowing 70?
Right.
And that's what I think we're talking about in markets now. What do you think the conditions are likely to be? And you have to survive those to trade another day or invest another day. And if you're just playing defense, you're not going to grow your wealth. So how do you intend to play defense and grow your wealth a family office has to have that conversation. And, you know, how do they do it? I don't know. You know, Fred and his friends get in a room and his relatives get in a room and they all listen to Harry and they do what Harry says. I guess that's one method. Or, you know, they hire experts and they do what the experts tell them to do, or some combination of those. But they have to start.
Right.
No, they have to start. They have to say, no, we have to have this conversation now, 2016, because things are not what they used to be.
Here's my prejudice. Having been, having had the opportunity to work with you and other people who are really, I think, masters of this craft, I really don't think that this is a do-it-yourself thing. I'm not saying you can't get started that way. I'm not saying you can't really spend some great time on the key, you know, finding the key variables or putting together stories. But I just don't think, I've seen it. We're all in, we're all in our own little bell jar. And every time I do this, I've done this with someone, with you or someone, you know, who's, well, as far as I'm concerned, you're the best I've ever worked with. But
so, well, I appreciate your saying that,
but I agree with you.
I just didn't want to appear to be hopelessly self-serving and say, you know, what should they do? They should call me. But I do think it's best done with a guide at the side and somebody who can help you find your way to what you need to think about.
Right.
You know, and use the techniques that have been developed to do it. And, you know, what I know is that it works. You know, it works. Over and over again, it works. People who, if you bring a bunch of smart people together to be thoughtful in a process that has been developed over time, that process will produce a good outcome for those people because they're smart, they're well-meaning, they know why they're there, they care, they want to make things happen. And oh, by the way, the byproduct of going through the process is that the group of people, you know, deepen and develop their relationship with each other intellectually and emotionally in the process. And that's very valuable going forward for them in many different ways besides just, you know, the scenario process or the investment process. So I would say yes, you know, get me or get somebody who you believe can be helpful and let them help.
And get out of the bell jar. I read a paper about 6 months ago, a group of academics had been commissioned to go talk to top leadership in both government and business and did over 100 interviews. And what they discovered was everybody was struggling with thinking the unthinkable because the level of uncertainty had risen to extraordinary levels and they really had no way of doing what you're describing. They had no way of getting in the room you know, in key cross sector groups to talk about this. And you thought, oh my God, how is a society, you know, they're so busy trying to get another penny on their earnings per share this quarter that they can't get out of that bell jar and say, okay, now how are we going to make sure as a society we're really doing what needs to be done to be successful in this environment? It was very, very,
very scary. Anyway,
One of the reasons for that is that you have a culture, which I saw on Wall Street of, you know, let's get somebody and put him in the corner office to fix it.
Right.
And they would get him and put him in the corner office and he wouldn't fix it. And then they'd get somebody else and put them in the corner office and he wouldn't fix it either because it turns out, no, it cannot be fixed by the guy in the corporate office. It has to be fixed by the community of practitioners who are interested in working on this in many dimensions. And you have to bring together the horizontal network crowd rather than think there's a vertical with a head at the top who knows the answer. No, there isn't. And so... Where is the leader who's courageous enough to say, I know that I don't know, and we're all smarter than any of us, and we will mobilize the collective intelligence, the wisdom of the crowd, not to get to some sort of neutral, mediocre consensus. No, to use the collective intelligence and the collective insight to find the really compelling idea that we realize we need to act on, even if we don't know for certain that it's right. We know it's a lot better than a lot of other stuff we were thinking about, and we have to get to that together. But you have systems, you know, market-driven systems, you know, share price-driven systems, corporate bureaucracy systems, government systems, political systems, where people are afraid of being wrong, of looking bad, of being duped, of stepping outside the crowd. So somebody asked me today, interestingly, I think they knew that I was going to be on this call, and this guy, a friend of mine, said to me, well, you know, you've been through all these scenario exercises. What would you say is thematic right now? And I said, what I think is thematic right now is that we have really serious governance problems.
Right.
We need a type of leadership that we don't have. We need a type of collaboration we don't have. We need a kind of intellectual honesty that we don't have. We need a kind of courage that we seem not to have. We need a kind of civil discourse that we seem to be unable to have. And while all of that is sort of failing, the system is kind of going sideways and down a bit because we're not dealing with the things we have to deal with.
Right.
So, this would be in the heart of the matter to me. What are the kinds of conversations leadership are going to generate?
Right. Well, part of it is when you have a debt finance growth model, it's one group of leaders who can slap out government money. It's another group of leaders who can optimize resources. It's a very different, you know, in one sense, you're going from a debt to equity model. So rather than having a group of people who are excellent at financial fraud, you might want some engineers. So part of it is the leadership. But it's funny what you said about looking for someone who can fix it, because, you know, we've been centralizing the economy. If we're going to rebuild it, we need to rebuild it on a decentralized basis, which gets down to me, my family, my community, mm-hmm. how the cash flows work here, which is very mm-hmm. different than where the cash flows work there. Instead, we're all running around, you know, looking at a campaign where we have two people saying, I'm the guy who can fix it.
Yeah, well, let me ask you something. Catherine, let me ask you this, okay? Let's say that God, who knows everything, and is a much meaner God than we thought, holds a gun to your head and says, uh-huh. okay, Catherine, I'm going to ask you a question. You get it wrong, I'm pulling the trigger.
Okay.
And you say, well, really? What's the question? Okay, my uh-huh. question is, do you think the system that you're describing can reform without a crisis of magnitude? Yes or no?
No.
Okay. I agree with you. It's a very unsettling thing to say, because we don't know how far down is down or how bad is bad. But going back to Japan in 97, there was a very clever economist for Morgan Stanley in Japan named Robert Feldman, who's very highly respected. And he described something called the crick cycle. And now I can't remember what CRIC altogether stood for, but the concept was basically we have a crisis, we have some reform, and then we slip back, and then we have another crisis. And so you could draw a kind of a loopy line going sideways, you know, up as we reform, sideways, crisis, we go down, and now we try to reform again. But we can never really get out of that loopy sideways movement because the crisis is never enough.
Right.
And the response to the crisis is never really the right response because we can't seem to come up with it. So I personally think that's a troubling possibility that, no, the debt's going to keep going on. The monetization's going to keep going on. It's not clear what's going to happen. The reform is not going to happen. The central banks don't really know what they're doing. There's a very crowded trade in, you know, U.S. treasuries or, you know, certain parts of the bond market. We're detached from fundamentals. The asset prices are going up because of the monetization that's gone on. And there's a big bang out there somewhere. When is it? I don't know. What form does it take? I don't know. What should I do? I'm really not sure.
Right.
You know,
that's
so that's why
you
do scenarios,
be
because that's the best you can do.
Right. Okay, so let me ask you a tough question. The challenge in doing great scenario design in this environment is getting everybody together. Is it possible to do this online? Is it possible to do some kind of process where it could be done through Skype or online mechanisms?
Do we have to be
maybe,
one or
but
the
I'm
other?
Not really. You know, I'm sure something of value can be done in that medium, and I'm sure there are people doing stuff which in that medium which they think has value. But I don't believe in it. I actually believe that human beings in the presence of one another, with the broadband communication that face-to-face provides, and however the universe really works, I don't know how it works, are we a function of, you know, the frequency on which light is translated into our bodies,
right,
our consciousness, whatever? I don't know. I'm not trying to get mystical here. I'm just saying what I believe is that people in a room together is the only way to do it, to bring that collective intelligence,
right,
and intuition and humanity and voice and sight and tone of voice and all of that together as you do an orchestra to try to produce music that's harmonious and follows,
right,
a line, you know, although it's much more the orchestra is creating the music that it's playing. But so I don't know what, if you had in mind a right answer to your question, but my answer would be, You could do preparatory things online, but you've got to get into,
right,
the room together.
Right. That's been my experience. And, well, Eric Best, it has been just a real pleasure to have you on the Soleri Report. Since everyone
Thank
at
you very much.
Is constantly required to read the book, The Evolution of Cooperation by Robert Axelrod, I just have to emphasize that you're the person who put me onto it.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. I greatly admire and rely on that book and its ideas. So
yeah.
I'm glad that you found it so valuable. And thank you very much. It's been great talking to you, and I hope this is helpful, and I hope that, you know, at least one listener out there got something that they can really use and that they use it.
So tell me how, just give us a minute and explain how we connect with you, how we find your website, and if someone wants to talk with you further, how they do so.
Right. So the website is ericbestonline.com. You'll find things to look at, read. Some of them are older than others, probably maybe too old. Otherwise, call me, 845-225-5030, or send me an email, eric@ericbestonline.com. And I'm also, you know, on LinkedIn, but I really prefer the email or phone channel.
Okay.
And I suppose if you wanted to send me a text, my cell phone is 516-712-7817. So if with all of that you can't find me, it's because you didn't want to.
Well, for those of you who can both, who need your service and can afford it, I will just say this. You come with my highest recommendation. We haven't worked together for many years, but there's nobody better at this, and it's an invaluable process, and I think they'll be very pleased. So,
well, I thank you for that very much, Catherine. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You have
it.
A great day, Eric. Bye.
Thank you. You too. Okay, bye-bye.